Okay, good morning everybody. Boker Tov. Apologize about
the confusion.
Slight confusion, let me put it that way, on the location. I just like a room with light. I really like with real light as opposed to whatever filtered light that you have in the other room. Before we begin looking at chapter 2, Perek Bet and the Megillah, I want to tell you about a certain personality. Which there's two pages that I've given out, taken from the book, which is called Kitavuni Ledorot. It's a quote from the Gemara. The author is a gentleman by the name Yoshua Bachrach. It's interesting. When I gave a lecture at YU on the Sunday program a number of years ago, and I mentioned Rav Bachrach, a number of ladies, it was to a ladies group, they came up to me afterwards and said, oh, he was my teacher. And it turns out that a lot of people had experience of learning with Rav Bachrach in Israel, if one was in Israel in the 70s and 80s, right up to he died in 1996. And the place where he particularly was active in one of the colleges known as Michlala, which is really one of the very top schools in Eretz Yisrael, in Yerushalayim, and was a very, very special man. I had the advantage, the privilege of knowing him in a limited capacity because he taught at my yeshiva program in Mevaseret Zion. We had two outstanding Bible teachers, in fact three. Nechama Leibowitz, who again was very well known, and she taught there for a number of years and again very influential in everything that I've been doing. And also, to a less extent, but someone who I've rediscovered, is Yoshua Bachrach. Yoshua Bachrach, if you look at the name, those of you who remember the orchestra, Backbert Backrack, right? It was like in the 70s. Apparently related. Had a connection to this gentleman. And he was of German extraction. Bachrach, there was a very famous author of responsa called the Chavos Yoed. Yoeb Bachrach, who is very well known, very interesting character in his own right. The responsa from approximately, how many years ago? Probably 200 years ago. And Yoshua Bachrach was really one of the greats, really one of the great teachers in Israel, totally unrecognized. Totally unrecognized. I hope that you're finding a seat. I hope you're good. What I want to share with you is a bit of a journey. He takes us on a journey when it comes to chapter 2 of the Megillah. Till now I've been looking through the eyes of Rav Benyamin Lau, the historical perspective on the Megillah, explaining to you that this is not a story in isolation, as we always seem to learn it, but it's actually a story which has incredible significance in the sort of the bigger history of the world. Right? We spoke about Xerxes, we spoke about the wars of the Persian Empire against the Greeks, and we did a timeline, if you remember, and in the timeline we found out that the story of Megillah happens essentially in a period of time between the period of Cyrus, the Persian emperor, allowing the Jews to go back to Israel and them not taking up the response, and eventually what happened was that 65 years later, approximately, Ezra comes back with his group of people from Persia or from Babylon, and the temple project is eventually completed. So in that period of 65 years, there was a kind of disconnect. The disconnect was towards Eretz Israel. There was a sense, and in fact, Rav Lau says it very clearly, there was a sense of the communities, particularly in the capital, in Shushan, being incredibly assimilated, all right? Something that we would recognize today, we would understand, and in those days it comes a bit of a shock. What I've done, or tried to do in the presentation of the Shiurim, is to, as I said last week, to shatter some illusions. One of the biggest illusions is that we've always assumed, you know, the hero and the heroine, Mordechai and Esther, good Jewish names, good Jewish protagonists, people, examples of what it means to lead the community. When you actually look into it, it's not so straightforward. And already we discussed last week in terms of the names that the Mordechai is a Persian name. Esther is also a Persian. Esther has a good Jewish name, Hadassah, which we're told, but she doesn't use. And even Mordechai, he comes from the Golah, he comes from the people exiled from Eretz Israel, but instead of adopting their particular name, he is back to his Persian name, Marduk. Marduk is one of the gods of Persia. So what we've been saying till now is that we're not necessarily dealing with the sort of people that we thought we were dealing with. We're dealing with a community which is assimilated. They go to the party. We know that they had the non-kosher food and all the rest of it. And we're dealing with essentially two main people in the Megillah so far who we can rightfully claim, although it comes a bit of a shock, that at the beginning of the story they were not the great examples of Jewish leadership, which obviously they did become later on. But at the beginning, they are presented to us essentially as assimilated Jews. And that's a big shock to the system. It's something, as I said, which is not obvious, something we may not have studied before, but I truly believe is a whole new approach to the Megillah. We're going to come back to this when we talk about the story when Haman raises his ugly head in chapter 3, which we'll discuss next week, please God, because there again there's a lot of stuff to say about even Haman's attack on the Jewish people. Was it initially an act of anti-Semitism or maybe something else? Alright, so all of our all the things that we thought are sacred about the Megillah, everything as far as I'm concerned at the moment is up for grabs. Okay, yes, please.
In 65 years.
Yeah. Yeah, it's difficult. We usually talk about a generation, I don't know, 40 years. So it probably was maximum two generations.
So possibly their commitment had nothing to do with the commitment.
During that period of time. Absolutely.
And where the commitment was, it would be from the original group that left.
Yeah, yeah. Correct. And in fact, that, of course, very much reflects the experience in America. Go two or three generations down the line. And Rabbi Epstein told the story on Shabbat of people came to the Friday night dinner last week and said, "You really do this every week?" And he had to explain to them that this is what your great-grandparents did every week as well. Just the tragedy is that you've gone two or three generations down the line and become disconnected from the beautiful tradition of Shabbat. And that's why that program, such a nice program, bringing people, reconnecting them to something that, you know, people say to me all the time, "Oh, I remember as a kid, used to do this. I used to take Lulav and Etrog to the hospital where I lived in London." People would say to me, "Oh, I remember doing this as a child." And I said, well, believe it or not, there are literally a million plus people in the world who are still doing it to this very day. And people would then get very teary and very emotional. It was always an interesting thing to see what would happen. The Bavitch Chabad are really into this. Put on tefillin, or do a mitzvah with somebody, and you wake up that little pilot light, right? You always talk about the pintaliyin. And Chabad are really good at that, and to their credit. No question about that. Alright, what I want to do is just look at chapter 2, but not verse by verse. Everyone knows the story. I'm going to concentrate on two items. If you open up your Chumash, page 1253. And what we're going to see, 1253, chapter 2, it's the Hebrew, which is half, three quarters of the way down in a heavy black print. Ish Yehudi, the famous pasuk, we actually say it out loud, right? We say it out loud. Ish Yehudi, Hayah B'Shushan HaBirah, there was a man of Judah, right? We're going to have to make up our mind what exactly Mordechai, what was his background? Was he a man of a tribe of Yehuda? Was he the tribe of Binyamin? Ushmo Mordechai ben Yoeh ben Shimi ben Kish ish Yemini. He was a man of Benjamin. So make up your mind. Is he a Benjaminite? Is he a Yehuda? So the rabbis say, easy. Father was from Benjamin. Mother was from Yehuda. But we're going to say more than that. And Rav Bachrach, one of the great things that he brings to the attention of students all the time in his lessons that he did and in his books, is the incredible connection, historical connection between what happens in the Torah and what happens in Jewish history much later. He says Mordechai really, let's think about it, Yehuda and Binyamin, the 10 tribes are gone. 10 tribes disappeared. Who was left? Yehuda and Binyamin, the two tribes that were left. Are we descended from Yehuda or Binyamin? Hopefully yes. My teacher in London was not so convinced, but basically, yes, unless you're a Kohen or a Levi, then you've got a special yichus, fine. But all of us come from Yehuda and Binyamin. The temple in Jerusalem was in the territory of Yehuda and Binyamin. If you just look at the description of the temple, part of the territory covered, mostly covered Yehuda, but there was a strip from Binyamin. There's been a historic awareness, connection between Yehuda and Binyamin all the way through Jewish history. All the way through Jewish history. And we've got it here embodied in Mordechai. And that's the first thing that Rabbi Bachrach points out. And he's going to make some fantastic comments in terms of the historical parallels that we have between characters in the Megillah and the characters that we read about, or that we learn about, going from the earliest days of Torah, from Sarah, and from Rachel, etc. Rachel, the mother of Benjamin. Okay, so again, he's going to show us how Esther, in her own way, reflects the tradition where she's coming from, and maybe even not realizing it. It was in her genes. It was something that she was born and bred with, and it's something that she reflected. But look at the next pasuk. And this is interesting, because this is an observation of Rav Bachrach, which I think is really worth noting. Verse 6 on page 1253, chapter 2. Asher hoglam Yerushalayim. They were exiled from Jerusalem. Im hagola asher hoglata michana melech Yehuda. Asher hagla Nebuchadnezzar melech Bavel. This is the only reference to Jerusalem in the whole of the Megillah. And again, you'll say to me, surely, we always talk about Yerushalayim. Imeshkachech Yerushalayim is one of those things. Every wedding we sing Imeshkachech. We are steeped in the concept of Yerushalayim. And here, Megillat Esther, which is written about the story of Esther, one mention of Yerushalayim. This is the first page I gave you, and I just want to show you what Rav Bachrach says about this, because it is so interesting. Again, I apologize, his stuff is not available in English. I photocopied the Hebrew, and I'll read it through with you as much as I can to explain it, bear with me if you're not comfortable reading the Hebrew, just hear me out, because it is really fascinating. He says like this, the pasuk which we just mentioned, this is the first page I gave you, Asher hoglam Yerushalayim, im hagola shehoglata michanya melech Yehuda, shehogla Nebuchadnezzar melech Bavel. Now, we know, Nohagim, what is the tradition when we read that pasuk? Likro pasuk ze benigun shemegillat Eicha. We read it to the tune of Eicha. The number of pasukim that we read in the Megillah, the tradition is to go to the Eicha tune, which we read on Tisha B'Av. We use on Tisha B'Av, and we use it for those verses. Okay. Arba pa'amim nizkerit ha-gola b'pasuk ze. So you'll see the word gola is repeated over here. Hogla, gola, hoglata, hegla. The word galut, all the four times in the pasuk. Lagid saram she Yisrael beit ahi. So clearly this is a diaspora community in great trouble. As we know, once Haman comes along, in really great trouble. Biyotam nidachim e'artzam. They're away from their country. Fuzarim furadim beino amim. Third line, they are separate from the nations. V'zeh klala agalut hakatub b'sefer Torah. This is what is written in the Torah, where it tells us that God will take us to a foreign land. This is the fulfillment of one of the curses of the Torah. Now, Yachad im Zeh, we're reading now, it's about 7 or 8 lines down. Listen to this. Yachad im Zeh, yesh letzayin, ki kan nizkeret Yerushalayim. We got Jerusalem being mentioned here. Vehi ha-pam ha-yichida. It's the only time. B'chol ha-megillah hazot. In the whole Megillah. Kavar omadnu al ze bipliyam. We already raised the problem. Kilam roch ezmanam komasha megillat Esther. Krovim od ezmanihem komam she Daniel ezer v'chemud. We've said this, that the story of Esther is very close to Daniel, to the story of Ezra and Nehemiah, who come along after the story of Esther. We know that that's all about returning to Eretz Yisrael. Shekol tochen sifrehem. You look at the books of Daniel, of Ezra and Nehemiah, who are Ratzon v'amaseh livnod chomot Yerushalayim lakim mikdash. They want to establish the Beit HaMikdash. Hine b'megillah zo. Bear with me, because I'll explain in a minute what he's getting at here. He says, in the Megillah, Ein kol zecher l'tikvat Zion. And this Rav Lau also said, there is this sense that we have no hope to go back to Eretz Yisrael at this point. L'gagu'ei Yerushalayim, or any feelings towards Jerusalem. We mention it once in Megillat Esther. It's almost as if, on purpose, we are not mentioning Jerusalem to show we are distanced from Jerusalem. Aval ha'emet. The truth is, ki agaguim ha'ele kayamim. We know Jerusalem is always at least in the back of our minds. Ahem k'mistatrim mitgalim po v'sham b'rimazim. We have sometimes references, indirect or direct. Kizu darkasha megillat Esther kol behester panim. What he's basically pointing out so beautifully is that the one mention of Jerusalem is for us significant, that again, about the assimilated community. We are 6,000 miles away from Yerushalayim, and there's no question about it. We always are thinking and our minds are directed towards Jerusalem. We can't avoid that. Right? We just had the news this week about the settlement. Jerusalem is one, believe it or not, Jerusalem is still considered, as far as the BBC is concerned, occupied territory. It's the biggest settlement that you've got in the whole of Israel. And if you want to call it that, whatever language you want to use. And again, we are hearing about events in Eretz Israel all the time. We're not divorced from it. In Shushan, they were disconnected. It's fascinating to imagine a community, and this just adds to what we were saying before. They don't have a feeling towards Jerusalem. Maybe there's a small group, we said, of what they call Chalutzim, who want to go back, but the vast majority of the community don't seem to be connected. Jerusalem is not in their radar, or not on their radar at this point. And I just wanted to bring this because it's an observation. And it's one of those quiz questions, you know, how many times is Jerusalem mentioned in the Megillah? And people will be shocked. It's like, how many times is Moshe mentioned in the Haggadah? Right? You expect Moshe to be in the Haggadah. What's the answer? Once. Right? He's mentioned once. And that's a big shock. You know, he's like the guy who makes it all happen, right? Not once, or only once in the Haggadah. Again, the significance of Moshe not being in the Haggadah is a whole thing that this is all about God, and not to take away from what Hashem did, etc. All of the Torah that is about that. He says at the bottom here, and this is very, very fascinating. Again, I mentioned here that Rav Lau, according to what we've been saying so far, of course will have slightly different approach to this, although it's really on the same lines as Rav Bachra. But Rav Lau would say it very clearly. Because the community was so assimilated and was so disconnected from their tradition, the concept of Jerusalem just wasn't there. There are beautiful traditions. I know my wife comes from a Germanic background. And in the Yeki tradition in Germany, every Jewish home would always have what they called a Mizrach sign. It wasn't just a wall or a patch which was left unpainted or something like that, which is a tradition I've seen many homes in Israel. But they actually had a wall on the east side of the house with a Mizrach sign. So that whenever you came into the house, the one side of the house is totally dedicated, in your mind at least, to Yerushalayim. Mizrach, Jerusalem, whatever it may be. And it's not by chance. These are not haphazard things. These are really important things that we keep reminding ourselves. All of the traditions of Tisha B'Av, sitting on the ground, everything that we do. This, again, Rav Lau would point out that when we're dealing with the Purim story, none of these connections really are in existence. It's quite shocking. Yeah.
I understand wanting to address why Yerushalayim only appears once, but the concept before it is kind of the anti-assimilation concept, right? If you take the time to lay out exactly where he came from and how he means he does have a memory.
That's a good question. Is it saying that, or is it saying, you know what, he came from such a solid background, and look what happened to him? And we're gonna dwell on this because Midrash supports the second approach. He became a general in the army of Persia. How did a Rosh Yeshiva, if we think that he's the great spiritual leader, what's he doing in? It's not Hezda. This is not the Israeli army, where he can, you know, he can daven three times a day. In that level, very unlikely, especially in Persia, especially in the Persian army. You know, this that there's a lot of stuff which is part of the Purim tradition, which shouts at us to say, get real about Mordechai. Not that we're talking about a bad person, Chas v'Shalom, but we're talking about a person who, through the story, grows. He develops. He's not already that great personality from day one. He becomes an incredible personality eventually through the story. And what I find so interesting, you know, at the end, it says, Mordechai Ratsui, he was acceptable. It doesn't say to everybody, Lerov Echad, only to the majority. That's the challenge of leadership. Even after, as you say in Yiddish, they save their tuchuses, he's still only Rov, only the majority likes him. All right? And that, again, is so interesting. So, who are we talking about here? Are we talking about the quintessential, you know, sort of rabbinic figure that we would imagine? Or are we talking about a person who maybe in his earlier life had a very cosmopolitan kind of out there career and became more focused on Jewish issues as he got older? Like very many people today who work in Federation and work in Jewish causes may have had business lives, they left them behind and went and devoted themselves more to the Jewish community. That's possible. You see what I'm trying to suggest there? A counterbalance to what you're saying.
So there's an idea that one of the audiences that you dealt with is Alfred Schrader.
Yeah.
So because to me it reads much more logically to say that what we're, especially in this section here, what we're really doing is establishing Rav Shvera, who Mordechai is, versus taking it from this that Mordechai is an assimilated Jew. It seems kind of very assertive to say this is specifically mentioning the
Ruach HaMetzar. Yeah. And sort of putting Achashverosh in his place.
I mean, it just seems
missing. And it's good that you're bringing up these points, and I appreciate them, because what it's showing is that Yesh Maladabeh, there's what to discuss. I'm trying to present to you the counterpoint, because that's what makes the whole thing so interesting. If we're going to just go through the whole thing over again and just learn it the way we've learned it, okay, well, we'll have a nice time, but I haven't challenged you. Here, I'm really trying to challenge it, and you're challenging me back. That's brilliant.
I'm not bothered by the idea that he's
listening. I'm very happy, because a lot of people would be. As I said, I wouldn't get away with this in certain places in the world. But you know what? I like this because it's challenging. It makes you think. It makes you look at the story again. It makes you find, believe it or not, I'll throw out a question, something that we're going to deal with next week, chapter 3. Mordechai doesn't bow down to Haman. So we get very excited. Mordechai, the quintessential Jew, Haman, the quintessential anti-Semite, and Mordechai makes a stand and he says, I'm not going to bow down to this Russia. One second, Mordechai, the quintessential Jew, you're not bowing down, you've endangered your whole nation. Because Haman is such a lunatic that he'll see you not bowing down, representing the whole of the Jewish people. What are you doing? Just give him a nod, take off your cap, just, you know, like before the queen, do a curtsy. I don't know, what do you want to do? Do something and don't endanger everybody around you. And Mordechai says, "Lo yichra, lo yishtachaveh." What's going on? The rabbis are really blown away by this. They can't understand. Yes, you know, if you say Mordechai is this real sort of kana'i, this zealot, and everything else, that would fit in. But it's a very extreme interpretation on one of the central items in the Megillah, and we need to develop maybe more about Mordechai to understand what was going on there. So that's what I'm trying to suggest, that, you know, there's ways of looking at these things, and it really is challenging.
In a way that Mordechai then might have realized, because we've learned all this from history ourselves, you can't appease these people.
Yeah.
So whatever he would have tipped his hat or anything that on him, in the long run,
it's not going to help.
Correct.
You know what? To endanger people on that assumption is a bit scary. if I say to myself, well, it doesn't really matter, you know, I'm not going to stand up to the anti-Semite because it's not going to help anyway. But, I mean, look what we're doing at the moment. Look at the security that we're now investing in because of Nebuch, what happened. It's a year ago. We should really dedicate today's lesson in memory of the people in Pittsburgh. You know, it's a year. And what happened in Poway and all the places, and God forbid, I hope it's not going to happen again, but who knows. And this is what's going on. For us to sort of shy away and say, this is all going to go away. This is what the Jews did in Europe, and we know where that ended up. Right? So I'm saying that with Mordechai doing what he did and endangering the community, we have to really come to terms with what Mordechai is, who he is, etc. And your approach is an approach, but it doesn't satisfy me enough. Okay? It satisfies me, but not quite enough. So we're going to come to that. And I'm glad you're thinking on the lines, because I'm challenging your assumptions. And that's not a bad thing, even if it's early in the morning. But I really want to do that. You got coffee, so you're awake. Please.
From what you've led us into these last three sessions, is that Mordechai is fully assimilated, and this makes it even more startling that he wouldn't bow down to Haman.
Yeah, I'm really jumping the gun for next week, but I'll just give you a little taster of what we're going to say. Sorry, yes. Yeah. Yeah. And this is where you're getting. This is what we're going to have to come to. Mordechai and Haman had a personal grievance between each other. It wasn't Mordechai saying, "I'm not bowing down to him because I'm Jewish and he's a goy and he's an avert." You know, he's wearing this getchka around his neck, the idol. I'm not bowing down to him because you know what? He owes me money. You know what? I lent him money in the army. He never paid me back. This shtickle, whatever you want to call it. He's an ice wolf. He's a terrible man. And Mordechai is saying that for me to bow down to him, what are you talking about? And when you actually look at the pasuk, we're going to go over this again next week, it says initially Haman started against doesn't say Am Yisrael. It says Am Mordechai. It's chapter 3. He had his beef with the fact that the Jews were the people of Mordechai, not because they're Jews, but because Mordechai is the guy who belongs to that crowd. Wasn't so much about the crowd, but it was about the person who belonged to the crowd. So that's a whole different approach. So this is why I'm suggesting to you, it's so fascinating what we're doing, because we are literally clearing the decks and looking at the whole thing afresh. And seeing an approach. And again, I'm not saying that other approaches are invalid, but this is just so interesting. Such a different way of looking at it. I want to go to the second page, because Rav Bachrach, and again, it looks very full, and I'm not going to in any way go through the whole thing, but I just want to show you some of what he says. In chapter 2, one of the most famous things, if you just go back to page 1253, you'll see on the in the story, we're going to just look at the continuation, verse 7, okay, on chapter 2, page 1253, near the bottom of the page. Verse 7. Well, just read a few psukim, and I'll elaborate on one problem, which I'm not going to give you an answer to now, but we'll deal with something else, which we all know the question, but you'll be amazed at some of the answers. Listen to this, verse 7. Vayhi omenet Hadassah, hi Esther bat Dodo. So he took over Hadassah. She was bat Dodo. Some say he was her uncle, some say he was a cousin, all right? Because bat Dodo literally means a cousin. She was orphan. Vanari fatari fatmare. She was very beautiful. Mordechai took her as a daughter. Say the rabbis, Amar Rabbi Meir and the Gemara, the most shocking thing, he married her. He married her. Two cousins can get married in Jewish law. That's not a problem. The problem is that once she's a married woman, what the blazes, pardon me saying so, is she doing, number one, going to the palace to be with Achashverosh. And even worse, and I'll tell you what really is the big problem, I'm not going to talk about now, is that she doesn't leave him. They have a child together. Sorry to spoil your day. Achashverosh and Esther have a child. And that child is called Darius. Unbelievable. And you know who Darius is? Later on, when the temple is being rebuilt, who gives permission to finish the project? The Persian leader, Darius. He's the guy who says you're allowed to do it. The son of Achashverosh and Esther. And we've got proof for this from Sefer Ezra. It makes an allusion to Esther. It's unreal. So making Esther into a married woman That creates a lot of problems. Palmi, so even if she's not a married woman, you'd say pasnish for a Yiddish atochta. All right, it's not right for a Jewish girl, but if she's a married woman, there are halakhic implications of her situation which are really, really difficult. So we're going to come to all of that. I'm not going to even remotely touch on that. That almost becomes the last lesson that we have on the Megillah, but we'll save it. But listen to this. The girls are being gathered together. Just turn over the page. And we know the famous command from verse 10. The third line on page 1254. Lo yigida Esther et ama bet moladata. Esther doesn't say where she comes from, her nation, her background. Ki Mordechai tziva alea asher lo tagid. Mordechai said, don't say a word. And later on, when she's actually taken into the palace, what does it say about her? I'll just show you further down, where it says, verse 16, Vatilokach Esther el Melech Achshveirosh. She was taken, and tilokach is passive, meaning she didn't want to go, but she was taken. She was forced to go. That's one of the explanations that the rabbis give about Esther's non-compliance. But, El Beit Malchuto, B'chodesh Asiri Chodesh Tevet, she went in the month of Tevet, Bishnat Sheva, we pointed out, was the seventh year of the reign of Achashverosh. Ve'ahava melech et Esther, and he loved her, etc., etc. And just a second, I think before that, where it says that she... one second. Tilakach Esther. Yeah. The whole story over here about her being taken, etc., and she came to the point. Yeah. And it just reinforces, I can't find the phrase, of course, when I'm looking for it, I can't find it. Pasuk 20, verse 20. Ein Esther mageret moladata v'tama. Esther does not reveal her background. Kasher tziva alea Mordechai, as Mordechai had said. So Mordechai said, don't do it. And later on, in verse 20, we're told Esther didn't do it. So there's something going on here. The whole question of Esther not revealing her background. What is going on? And when you look at the Mefarshim, it is mind-blowing. This is the page you have in front of you. I'm just going to show you through it, 1, 2, 3 on the right-hand side at the top. Listen to this. It is totally unbelievable because the commentaries here are literally going from one extreme to the other. Is she being told not to reveal who she is, because if she reveals who she is, she hasn't got a chance in a million of getting accepted? Or maybe looking at it, as you'll see, from another direction. Listen to this. We'll do number one. It's three lines down. All this is Rashi. Rashi says, why did Mordechai say, don't say who you are? Kedei sheyomru, because that's in order that people will say, shehi mishpacha bezuya v'yishalchua. Right? Because people might say that if they find out who she is, well, she's certainly not fit to be the queen. She comes from such a low level of people. She'im yeidu shehi mishpachat Shaul ha-melech hayu machzikim bo. Her yichus, where does she come from? She is descended from King Saul. And if she says to Achashverosh, I'm coming from King Saul's family, Achashverosh may very well say, oi, it's another Vashti. I'm marrying another woman and she's got the yichus and I haven't. So you know what he's going to say to himself? Better not to take her in the first place. He's not a fool. Remember, we're dealing with Xerxes. He's a smart man. He runs half the world. And what we're suggesting, according to Rashi, is that Mordechai is telling Esther, keep quiet, because if you say who you are, he's not going to take her because you've got too much yichus. You're too, you know, you're the girl that everyone wants to marry because you come from such a strong background. So that's Rashi's interpretation. Be quiet. Don't say who you are. So you know what? You've got a chance. Maybe Achashverosh will marry you. Look at number two. This is coming from the Ibn Ezra. Listen to this. It's just amazing how these rabbis can look at this from all different sides. Somebody once said to me, beautiful mashal. He said, Torah is like holding up a special prism, a glass, which has all different sides. And when you look at it and you turn it around, you've got all different reflections, all different colors. The 70 panim, the 70 panim la Torah. The beautiful thing about studying this is that there are so many nuances. And that's what's so beautiful in Torah study. We can study things and find these different references and these different nuances. And it's exciting. It makes the whole thing so, so uplifting. Look at number two. Yesh Omrim. This is Ibn Ezra. He says, Ibn Ezra also, Middle Ages, a bit around the time of Rashi, a little bit after Rashi. I'll talk about Ibn Ezra another time. Yesh Omrim. Ki Mordechai lo asa nechona. Mordechai made a mistake by telling her not to reveal who she is. That's not like Rashi. Rashi says, you've got to keep quiet. Keep shtum. And Mordechai, and Ibn Ezra says, no, Mordechai made a mistake. She had sival Esther shalota gidamad, to tell Esther not to say who she was. Ki pachan. Why did Mordechai make that announcement for her? Shelo yikachena melech liisha. He doesn't want her to be taken as a wife. Im yeda shehi meagola. Because what will happen is that maybe if Mordechai, if Achashverosh knows that Esther is a girl from the exile, and forget about her yichus of King Saul, just the fact that she is a refugee, he may very well want to take her. Not like Rashi said he won't want to take her. Says Ibn Ezra, he will. He will want to take her because she's a refugee. She actually is absolutely zero threat to Achashverosh. Vashti, 100% threat, because she's the granddaughter of the great king Nebuchadnezzar. Esther, at this point, zero threat. Why zero? Because she's a refugee. Don't know who she is. She's come from another country. Probably doesn't even speak Persian so well. Who knows? And therefore, Mordechai is, by telling her to be quiet, hoping, against hope, that she won't be taken. Because, you know, if the reality of it is that if she reveals that she is a refugee, he may very well take her. So you know what he says to her? Don't say a word. Don't say who you are. Don't say where you come from. And, you know, with a bit of luck, he'll just ignore you. There's thousands of other girls in line. And he says, "V'acherim omru," and there are other people who see exactly the opposite. "Ki b'davar nevuah, o b'chalom yoda." Maybe Mordechai had a dream, or he had a prophecy. "Shetavo teshua al yadal Yisrael," that she has to be taken because she's going to provide the salvation for Israel. So basically, what some rabbis say is that in terms of Esther being quiet, it may very well be that if she said who she was, she doesn't stand a chance because of her yichud. Or it could very well be that if she says who she is and she's treated as a refugee, maybe that she does stand the ultimate chance of being taken by the king because he doesn't want anyone who's going to threaten his position. Or it could be that Mordechai is telling her not necessarily to say anything because at the end of the day, she's going to be the salvation for Israel. Who knows how, but hopefully not with marrying Achashverosh. And look how interesting, it all goes in all different directions. And look at number three, Benachon Be'enai, says Ibn Ezra, you know what, I disagree with everybody. And he says, Ki asazeh Mordechai, why did Mordechai tell her not to say a word? Bavur she'tishmo Torat Hashem b'seter, because he wants her to be a nice Jewish girl. And if she's going to be in the palace, how is she going to keep Shabbos? How is she going to keep kosher? How is she going to do anything? So you know what?
Why is she keeping kosher?
That's the point. According to what we've been saying, maybe not so much. But Ibn Ezra says, according to his interpretation, maybe we can say, yes, Mordechai wanted her to. We're not sure what she did, but Mordechai wanted her to. And the last thing that would give her the ability to keep it under wraps is by announcing that she's Jewish. As soon as she announces she's Jewish, she's out of there. Right? And Mordechai wants her to be able to be in a position that at least, you know, she'll take a salad, as we say. She won't eat the meal, but she'll eat the salad. Okay? And if she wants to wash her hands, she'll make an excuse. And it says she even had different women serving her every day, so she knew who the Shabbos goy was, as they say. The Shabbos goy came in, and she would look after on Shabbat, and that would remind Esther that today is Shabbat. It is a wonderful story, Dudu Fisher. Dudu Fisher was in Les Miserables in London. He was in Les Mis, famous. And he didn't do Friday night. Didn't do Friday night. Right? The same here. And he spoke about it once. He had a stand-in. And apparently they had this, they shared a room, you know, a dressing room. And he had his mirror. And the stand-in had his seat with his mirror next to it. You know what Dudu Fisher put on top of the mirror of the stand-in? Shabbos goy. He wrote that on top of the mirror because the guy was a Shabbos guy. He was doing it for Dudu Fisher. It's an amazing story. He made a joke out of it, but it's very funny. When you think about it, it's a wow. That somebody could actually hold that down. Not for very long, I have to say. It must have been very difficult for him. But he managed to do that. It's a famous, very famous thing. I just want to read what Rebecca says about all of this that we've said so far. And this is the next paragraph. Under the three, you'll see there's five lines. L'pachot, shalosh deot shamanu ad kan. So at least three opinions that we've heard till now why Esther was told not to say who she was. And we're going on a journey. We started with Rashi, the 1000s. We went with Ibn Ezra, the 1100s. Then we're going to go into history. You'll see in a minute, we're going to go to the 1600s. Everybody through Jewish history has got something to say about this. And that's why it's such an interesting thing to look at. But let's just see very quickly his conclusion here. Reb Bachrach, he says, Ki ratzah bezeh latzil et Esther. The whole idea of Mordechai telling Esther not to say who she is because he wants to save her. Shelo tibachel l'malchut, that she won't be chosen. Shoneh mimena hidata yishomrim, but there's one opinion that seems to suggest Amnam ratzah Mordechai shetibachel. Mordechai wants her to be chosen because she's the salvation for the Jews. He wants her to be chosen. And that, believe it or not, ties in with what Rav Lau said. Rav Lau, 21st century, he says Esther was looking from a secular point of view to go up the scale, to try and improve her situation. How do you do that? By applying for the job of queen. How do you lose that position? By announcing you're Jewish. As soon as you announce it, it's like trying to be a Jewish president in America. It's just very nice thought, but it's just not going to happen. We know this, right? Or at least maybe not in our time. Maybe come back in 100 years, it may happen. I don't know. And it was nice when Joe Lieberman tried, and he's a very special man. But the reality of it is, you know, we're not, the country, as they say, is not ready for certain things. And that is, again, what we're saying here about Mordechai and Esther, that maybe Esther's being told not to say who she is so that she has a better chance of winning the beauty contest. We saw that last week. So look at all the different opinions here, ranging from Mordechai trying to keep her away from the job to the point where we're saying Mordechai is giving her an answer how to get the job, how to become chosen. Don't announce who you are. Either he'll see you as a competition and he won't want to take you. If you announce who you are, he might have Rachmanis on you, and I don't want that to happen. And in the end, if you're going to be chosen because you're the salvation of the Jewish people, whatever way it's going to happen, but I don't want it to happen in this very undignified way of being taken to the palace and being literally sort of spending the night with the king and all the rest of it. Not for you. So look at the way all of this sort of, you know, revolves and is looked at in all different directions. It's fascinating.
But later on in the story, Mordechai tells her, for this reason is why you're here.
Correct. Eventually he does explain to her, and that ties in with what it says. Maybe that was part of his revelation that he had, the dream. You're here because I know instinctively or whatever that you're part of the solution, you're not part of the problem, right? And that fits in essentially not with every opinion over here, but with some of the opinion. Well, what is so wonderful when you learn these types of different views is you understand that nothing but nothing is set in stone, and that's what makes Torah so vibrant. It makes it vibrant because nothing is just one interpretation and that's it. One of the things that I did in England for many years is teach in a non-Jewish school. I taught Jewish boys who came out of their regular Sunday lesson and they came to the Jewish class. And I got to know the Christian ministers there, the pastors, right? And it was a very interesting school, one of the schools where the royalty goes, certainly different parts of the world. And one of the things that always bothered me is when we had a discussion on Bible, they couldn't handle Rashi and Tosfos. They really couldn't handle it. They could handle Rashi, and they could handle a Tosfos. That was one approach. But when you start saying, well, there's this way, and there's that way, and whatever, they couldn't handle it. They just couldn't come to terms with such interpretations of the Bible the way that we do it. And this is one of the great things that we have.
In other words, they wanted one solution, and that's it.
And usually to fit in an agenda, which they have, proving that their savior is the savior. It's usually what it boils down to. When they give an interpretation with the Akedah and all the rest of it, they've taken the stories, they borrowed them, stolen them, some would add, and adapted them to their purposes. As far as we're concerned, we have an open playing field. And I hope this, if anything comes out of these shiurim, it has to be that studying Megillat Esther also is an open field. And how interesting it becomes.
making it real, making the whole story relevant, making the whole story mean something, a community that forgets Eretz Yisrael. Well, that's not exactly so far removed from some of the experiences that, you know, we've read about. Right, the European Jewry in the 1920s and 30s, most of the rabbis said, don't touch Israel, it's a treif and a medina. I think America was a bit more treif, but it was in the same league as America for many of the Jews living in Europe. And Nebuch, let's call it a mistake, but it's more than a mistake. It's a horrible thing that happened. So, you know, there is so much relevance here to this story, to the modern Jewish experience. That's why it's such an interesting thing to study. And I just want to say, I'm seeing my time is running away. Just want to show you the whole thing about Esther and Sarah, because this is really something else. Esther eventually refuses to say who she is. And according to tradition, it lasts for 4 years. We've just read the story of Sarah. They go down to Egypt. What happened to Sarah in Egypt? She's immediately taken to the palace of Pharaoh. Right? And what did Avram say to her?
Tell them.
You're my sister. Don't say who you really are. Right? Isn't that interesting?
They'll kill me.
Otherwise they'll kill me. Look at what's going on here with Mordecai. He says to Esther, don't say who you are. Otherwise, we're going to be in trouble. If you learn that's the interpretation. There is something here. Where does Esther get the car to be able to withstand the interrogation? She must have been interrogated. And the first question in any interrogation is, who are you? Right? You're going to end up marrying the king. I want to know who you are. And she resisted. You know, she would say, I'm Esther, and that's it. And no comment or plead the fifth or whatever they did in Persia in those days. She would say nothing. Where did she get that koach from? Says Reb Bachra, she got it from her Alter Bubba. Who is the Alter Bubba? Sora. When Sora went to Mizraim, right? When Sora went to Mizraim, she developed that sense of being able to resist, to say, not say who she is. She rejected all of the comments that came towards her, and she followed exactly what Avraham Avinu told her. And Reb Bachra, he's big into this. He says that everything that we read in the Torah, in those kind of interesting stories that we have coming up now, next few weeks, they become paradigms for the future of Jewish survival, Jewish existence. And let me show you this paragraph over here. On the left-hand side, five lines from the bottom of the first page. Ulai, lechein katav be'estel beit ha'melech, she was taken to the house of the king. Be'av ki lefiyeh met adai lo nukha l'sham, and really she wasn't yet taken there. He's got a whole discussion which I'm not going to go into. Ela kedei lahakbil matzava, what are we doing? We're finding a parallel between her situation of Esther lematzava shel Sarah Imenu, to the situation of Sarah. That's fascinating. B'sha'ata, because in her day, in Sarah's day, ki bilakhal beit paro, when she was taken to the house of Pharaoh, b'galut arishona shel avi umah, when the first exile took place, when Avram goes to Israel, and immediately has to leave, we read it 2 weeks ago, ni'ata Sarah aim v'siman. She became that force, that mother, that strength, l'chol benot Yisrael, for all future daughters of Israel, ba'asher tiyena shvuyot begaliyot unutunot lamacher, when they're under the control of another nation. Sarah gave that initial strength to the future of these phenomenal women in Jewish history who could all withstand the pressure of going or giving in to the questions or to demand of the people around them. And he goes even further because he said it's not just about Sarah. This is what really is something. I've just got to get the page. Just turn over just for 2 seconds because I just want to finish this thought. He also points out, there's a long, long piece of it. Again, I just want to show you this. He says that also he finds there is a parallel here between Esther and also Rachel. Between Esther and Rachel, who she was directly descended from as well. Let me just see where I can find it, where he actually says it here. Just 1 second. Yeah. He talks about the fact that she achieved a tremendous amount of chesed, tremendous amount of kindness, and he compares her to Yosef. right? Which again, Yosef in jail managed to achieve tremendous chesed. And the fact is that Esther also, when she was taken into the palace, seems to have been treated in a very, very kind way. In the end of the day, she wasn't persecuted for who she was. And what Rabbi Achrach is doing, and I can't find the exact piece, but maybe I'll bring it to you next time, is to say that in Jewish history, and this is his approach in many, many stories, he says that very often the attitude or that we have to understand, we should adopt, is to realize that what the Avot, what the fathers and mothers of the nation did, is give us the strength to withstand or to overcome situations much, much later on in history. One example, just a simple example, but so beautiful. We know that in the story of, we're going to read in a few weeks' time, the story of Yehuda and Binyamin. Binyamin is someone who is demanded by Yosef, bring him down to Egypt. Right? All the rabbis are perplexed. Why is Yosef so demanding of this? Some say because he wanted to see the brothers, if the brothers did tshuva. Joseph was sold, Binyamin won't be sold, so they showed that they've changed their tune, as they say. And the problem there is that, obviously, it's very difficult for the father to let him go. So who stands up for Binyamin at that moment? Yehuda. Yehuda says, I am going to be the protector of Benjamin. Says Rabbi Bachrach in many places, and this is also relevant to Mordechai, the relevance of that story is that Yehuda and Binyamin as a team become almost, not totally, but almost invincible. They literally protect each other, they stand up for each other, they look out for each other, and he says later on, David HaMelech, who goes to the front line to Shaul to visit his brothers, is in fact also fulfilling that mission of looking after Shaul. Where is Shaul from? The tribe of Benjamin. Where is David from? The tribe of Yehuda. Back to what we said at the beginning. Mordechai. Ish Yehudi, Ish Yemini. In Mordechai is really established, and whatever approach you take to him, whether you follow Reb Lau or not, the reality is Mordechai is the quintessential example in history of Binyamin and Yehuda working together. Because in him, you find both Yehuda from one side of the family and Binyamin from the other side of the family. And that's why it becomes so intense, so powerful. In the end of the day, in Jewish history, it's going to be Yehuda and Binyamin looking out for each other. And particularly Yehuda is in the story looking out for Binyamin. And in the world that we live in today, that we believe that's where we're coming from, we've just relived all of this all over again in the 20th, 21st century. We as a nation are coming together, Yehuda from one side, Binyamin from the other side. And what are we doing? We're rebuilding Eretz Israel all over again. It's an incredible thing. There is this historical dynamic which started thousands of years ago and carries on right through to the present day and beyond. And that is, again, one of the real revelations of the story. Esther protects Mordechai in a way by not revealing who she is, but she's also protecting herself, and in the end, she is protecting the Jewish people. And how does she get the strength to do that? Because she comes from such a long line of incredible people who did actions at the time which not only was relevant when they did them, but became so much more important later on in Jewish history as well. One example, another, I mean, there's so many examples of this. In David and Shaul, the balance between Yehuda and Binyamin. Who fights Goliath in the end? David, right? Who's meant to fight Goliath? Shaul. And of course, Goliath represents evil in the world. David and Shaul, Binyamin and Yehuda represent holiness in the world. So again, David stands in. It doesn't make sense. He's a little, I mean, he's not so young there, according to tradition. He's not a boy. He's probably in his late 20s. But it doesn't matter. Goliath is 10 foot tall. David is 5 foot tall. And he's throwing stones at him. One stone hits the spot. And what is the story really about? It's about Yehuda again looking out for Binyamin. Shaul is petrified of Goliath. David represents the strength of Yehuda, the historical commitment to look out for Binyamin. And that's what Mordechai is about. Even if you're saying he doesn't necessarily represent at the beginning, but he becomes that. And I just wanted to share this with you, this approach of Rabbi Achrach, because it's so beautiful. It is so, it's just, to me, this is like putting poetry into prose. It's so poetic.
And it's so powerful. And we'll follow this through a bit more as we go through the text. The next week, I just want to leave you with that problem that we started off with, more or less at the beginning, Mordechai endangering the Jewish people. We've always accepted that, you know, that's what he did, that's how he behaved, but was it absolutely, number one, acceptable, and number two, let's put a very blunt question, was it really necessary? Did Mordechai have to make such a statement against Haman at that time? To be continued, Bezrat Hashem, next Wednesday morning. Leave you with a bit of homework. Why not? It's what I do. I hope that was clear, and really, this is just getting more, I hope, more interesting as we go along. Thank you, everyone. Thank you to the Millers again for providing the refreshments. It's always appreciated. Thank you. Have a good day, everybody. Thank you very much.